Chapter 23. Captain Walker made her very unhappy. He died in America, sir, of this, I fear, pointing to the bottle, and Mrs. W. quitted the stage a year before I quitted business. Are you going on to Wiesbaden? They went off in their carriage that evening, the boy on the box making great efforts to blow out of the postillion's tasseled horn. I am glad that poor Morgan is happy at last, and hasten to inform you of the fact. I am going to visit the old haunts of my youth at Pumpernickel. Adieu. Yours, G.F. B., Mr. and Mrs. Frank Berry. Chapter I, The Fight at Slaughterhouse. I am very fond of reading about battles, and have most of Marlborough's and Wellington's at my fingers' ends. But the most tremendous combat I ever saw, and one that interests me to think of more than Malplaquet or Waterloo, which, by the way, has grown to be a downright nuisance, so much do men talk of it after dinner, prating most disgustingly about the Prussians coming up, and what not, I say the most tremendous combat ever known was that between Barry and Biggs the Gaunt Boy, which commenced in a certain place called Middle Briars, situated in the midst of the cloisters that run along the side of the playground of Slaughterhouse School, near Smithfield, London. It was there, madam, that your humble servant had the honor of acquiring, after 6 years' labor, that immense fund of classical knowledge which in after life has been so exceedingly useful to him. The circumstances of the quarrel were these. Biggs, the Gaunt Boy, a man who, in those days, I thought was at least 7 feet high, and was quite thunderstruck to find in after life that he measured no more than 5 feet four, was what we called Eakin Cock of the school. The first cock was a great big, good-humored, lazy, fair-haired fellow, old Hawkins by name, who, because he was large and good-humored, hurt nobody. Biggs, on the contrary, was a sad bully. He had half a dozen facts, and beat them all unmercifully. Moreover, he had a little brother, a boarder in Peaky's house, whom, as a matter of course, he hated and maltreated worse than anyone else. Well, one day, because young Biggs had not brought his brother his hoops, or had not caught a ball at cricket, or for some other equally good reason, Biggs the elder so belabored the poor little fellow, that Barry, who was sauntering by, and saw the dreadful blows which the elder brother was dealing to the younger with his hockey stick, felt a compassion for the little fellow. Perhaps he had a jealousy against Biggs, and wanted to try a few rounds with him, but that I can't vouch for. However, Barry passing by, stopped and said, "Don't you think you have thrashed the boy enough, Biggs?" He spoke this in a very civil tone, for he never would have thought of interfering rudely with the sacred privilege that an upper boy at a public school always has of beating a junior, especially when they happen to be brothers. The reply of Biggs, as might be expected, was to hit young Biggs with the hockey stick twice as hard as before, until the little wretch howled with pain. "Suppose it's no business of yours, Barry," said Biggs, thumping away all the while, and laid on worse and worse. Until Barry and, indeed, little Biggs, could bear it no longer, and the former, bouncing forward, wrenched the stick out of old Biggs' hands, and sent it whirling out of the cloister window, to the great wonder of a crowd of small boys, who were looking on. Little boys always like to see a little companion of their own soundly beaten. "There," said Barry, looking into Biggs' face, as much as to say, "I've gone and done it," and he added to the brother, "Scud away, you little thief, I've saved you this time." "Stop, young Biggs," roared out his brother after a pause, "or I'll break every bone in your infernal scoundrelly skin." Young Biggs looked at Barry, then at his brother, then came at his brother's order, as if back to be beaten again, but lost heart, and ran away as fast as his little legs could carry him. "I'll do for him another time," said Biggs. "Here, under boy, take my coat," and we all began to gather round, and formed a ring. "We had better wait till after school, Biggs," cried Barry, quite cool, but looking a little pale. "Here are only 5 minutes now, and it will take you more than that to thrash me." Biggs upon this committed a great error, Therefore he struck Barry slightly across the face with the back of his hand, saying, "You are in a funk." But this was a feeling which Frank Barry did not in the least entertain. For, in reply to Bick's backhander, and as quick as thought, and with all his might and main palm, he delivered a blow upon old Bick's nose, that made the claret spurt, and sent the second cock down to the ground, as if he had been shot. He was up again, however, in a minute, his face white and gashed with blood, his eyes glaring, a ghastly spectacle. And Barry, meanwhile, had taken his coat off, and by this time there were gathered in the cloisters, on all the windows, and upon each other's shoulders, 120 young gentlemen at the very least, for the news had gone out through the playground of fight between Barry and Biggs. But Barry was quite right in his remark about the propriety of deferring the business, for at this minute Mr. Chip, the second master, came down the cloisters going into school, and grinned in his queer way as he saw the state of Bick's face. "Halloa, Mr. Biggs," said he, "I suppose you have run against a finger post. That was the regular joke with us at school, and you may be sure we all laughed heartily. As we always did, when Mr. Chip made a joke, or anything like a joke. You had better go to the pump, sir, and get yourself washed, and not let Dr. Buckle see you in that condition." So saying, Mr. Chip disappeared to his duties in the under-school, whither all we little boys followed him. It was Wednesday, a half-holiday, as everybody knows, and boiled beef day at Slaughterhouse. I was in the same boarding house with Barry, and we all looked to see whether he ate a good dinner, just as one would examine a man who was going to be hanged. I recollected, in after life, in Germany, seeing a friend who was going to fight a duel eat five larks for his breakfast, and thought I had seldom witnessed greater courage. Barry ate moderately of the boiled beef, boiled child we used to call it at school, in our elegant, jocular way. He knew a great deal better than to load his stomach upon the eve of such a contest as was going to take place. Dinner was very soon over, and Mr. Chip, who had been all the while joking Barry, and pressing him to eat, called him up into his study, to the great disappointment of us all, for we thought he was going to prevent the fight, but no such thing. The Reverend Edward Chip took Barry into his study, and poured him out two glasses of port wine, which he made him take with a biscuit, and patted him on the back, and went off. I have no doubt he was longing, like all of us, to see the battle, but etiquette, you know, forbade. When we went out into the green, old Hawkins was there, the great Hawkins, the cock of the school. I have never seen the man since, but still think of him, as of something awful, gigantic, mysterious. He who could thrash everybody, who could beat all the masters, how we longed for him to put in his hand and lick Buckle. He was a dull boy, not very high in the school, and had all his exercises written for him. Buckle knew this, but respected him, never called him up to read Greek plays, passed over all his blunders, which were many, let him go out of half-holidays into the town as he pleased. How should any man dare to stop him, the great, calm, magnanimous, silent strength? They say he licked a life guardsman. I wonder whether it was Shaw, who killed all those Frenchmen. No, it could not be Shaw, for he was dead au champ d'honneur, but he would have licked Shaw, if he had been alive. A bargeman I know he licked, at Jack Randall's in Slaughterhouse Lane. Old Hawkins was too lazy to play at cricket. He sauntered all day in the sunshine about the green, accompanied by little Tippins, who was in the sixth form, laughed and joked at Hawkins eternally, and was the person who wrote all his exercises. Instead of going into town this afternoon, Hawkins remained at Slaughterhouse, to see the great fight between the second and third cocks. The different masters of the school kept boarding houses such as Peakey's, Chip's, Wickens, Pinney's, and so on, and the playground, or green as it was called, although the only thing green about the place, was the broken glass on the walls, that separate Slaughterhouse from Wilderness Row and Goswell Street. Many a time have I seen Mr. Pickwick look out of his window in that street, though we did not know him then. The playground, or green, was common to all. But if any stray boy from Peaky's was found, for instance, in or entering into Chip's house, the most dreadful tortures were practiced upon him. As I can answer in my own case. Fancy, then, our astonishment at seeing a little 3-foot wretch, of the name of Wills, one of Hawkins' facts, they were both in Peaky's, walk undismayed amongst us lions at Chip's house, as the rich and rare young lady did in Ireland. We were going to set upon him, and devour or otherwise maltreat him, when he cried out in a little shrill impertinent voice, "Tell Barry I want him." We all roared with laughter. Barry was in the sixth form, and Wills or any under boy would as soon have thought of anting him as I should of wanting the Duke of Wellington. Little Wills looked round in an imperious kind of way. "L," says he, stamping his foot, "do you hear? Tell Barry that Hawkins wants him. As for resisting the law of Hawkins, you might as soon think of resisting immortal Jove." Barry and Tolmash, who was to be his bottle holder, made their appearance immediately, and walked out into the green where Hawkins was waiting, and, with an irresistible audacity that only belonged to himself, in the face of nature and all the regulations of the place, was smoking a cigar. When Barry and Tolmash found him, the three began slowly pacing up and down in the sunshine, and we little boys watched them. Hawkins moved his arms and hands every now and then, and was evidently laying down the law about boxing. We saw his fist starting out every now and then with mysterious swiftness, hitting one, two, quick as thought, as if in the face of an adversary. Now his left hand went up, as if guarding his own head. Now his immense right fist dreadfully flapped the air, as if punishing his imaginary opponent's miserable ribs. The conversation lasted for some 10 minutes, about which time Gown Boy's dinner was over, and we saw these youths, in their black horned button jackets and knee breeches, issuing from their door in the cloisters. There were no hoops, no cricket bats, as usual on a half holiday. Who would have thought of play in expectation of such tremendous sport as was in store for us? Towering among the Gown Boys, of whom he was the head and the tyrant, leaning upon Bushby's arm, and followed at a little distance by many curious pale-awe-stricken boys, dressed in his black silk stockings, which he always sported, and with a crimson bandana tied round his waist, came Biggs. His nose was swollen with the blow given before school, but his eyes flashed fire. He was laughing and sneering with Bushby, and evidently intended to make mincemeat of Barry. The betting began pretty freely. The bets were against poor Barry. 5-3 were offered in ginger beer. I took 6-4 in raspberry open tarts. The upper boys carried the thing farther still. And I know for a fact that Swang's book amounted to £4.3, but he hedged a good deal, and Tittery lost 17 shillings in a single bet to Pitts, who took the odds. As Biggs and his party arrived, I heard Hawkins say to Barry, "For heaven's sake, my boy, fib with your right, and mind his left hand." Middle Briars was voted to be to confine a space for the combat, and it was agreed that it should take place behind the underschool in the shade, whither we all went. Hawkins, with his immense silver hunting watch, kept the time, and water was brought from the pump close to Nutley's the pastry cook's, who did not admire fisticuffs at all on half holidays, for the fights kept the boys away from his shop. Gutley was the only fellow in the school who remained faithful to him, and he sat on the counter the great gormandizing brute, eating tarts the whole day. This famous fight, as every slaughterhouse man knows, lasted for 2 hours and 29 minutes, by Hawkins' immense watch. All this time the air resounded with cries of, "Oh it, Barry! Gee go it, Biggs! Pee pitch into him! Give it him!" and so on. Shall I describe the 102 rounds of the combat? No. It would occupy too much space, and the taste for such descriptions has passed away. 3. First round. Both the combatants fresh, and in prime order. The weight and inches somewhat on the Gown Boy's side. Barry goes gallantly in, and delivers a clinker on the Gown Boy's jaw. Biggs makes play with his left. Barry down. *. Fourth round. Claret drawn in profusion from the gown boy's grog shop. He went down, and had his front tooth knocked out, but the blow cut Barry's knuckles a great deal.
*15th round. Chancery. Fibbing. Biggs makes dreadful work with his left. Breakaway. Rally. Biggs down. Betting still 6-4 on the gown boy.
*20th round. The men both dreadfully punished. Barry somewhat shy of his adversary's left hand.
*29th-42nd round. The chip side all this, while breaks away from the gown boy's left, and goes down on a knee.
6-4 on the gown boy, until the 40th round, when the bets became equal.
*100th and last round. For half an hour the men had stood up to each other, but were almost too weary to strike. The gown boy's face hardly to be recognized, swollen and streaming with blood. The chip side in a similar condition, and still more punished about his side from his enemy's left hand. Barry gives a blow at his adversary's face, and falls over him as he falls. The gown boy can't come up to time. And thus ended the great fight of Barry and Biggs. And what, pray, has this horrid description of a battle and parcel of schoolboys to do with men's wives? What has it to do with men's wives? A great deal more, madam, than you think for. Only read chapter 2, and you shall hear. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.